thereafter. A pilot was hurt, and the decision was made at that point no longer to board even foreign vessels at Hinchinbrook, but we would board foreign vessels, or the pilots would, at Bly Island. And that's what's been done. There's only 9 foreign ships in there. Thereafter, a pilot was hurt, and the decision was made at that point no longer to board even foreign vessels at Hinchinbrook, but we would board foreign vessels, or the pilots would, at Bly Island. And that's what's been done. There's only 9 foreign ships in there, I guess, per month. Is that... there's only 9 foreign ships in the trade. There's about 74 U.S. vessels in the trade. We board them at Rocky Point, which is well inside of... and so whether you ought to do it at Hinchinbrook, it's very dangerous. It's rough, as you know, and it would be a major effort to do that, but I'm open to that.
Admiral, is it? I think it would work, and if the water's so rough, they can go all the way to L.A., and I'm confident that the oil companies would pay for it right now. And the second thing is that I want to make it clear for the record, those foreign vessels are not shipping that oil to foreign countries. It is still coming to the United States. Last thing, Admiral, is that the comment from the chairman about federalizing. I know there's been some discussion of that. The governor's requested it now. It appears to me your answer is very clear. The money is not there, and if we were to federalize it, would that relieve Exxon from any of the responsibility of the spill?
I think if we federalized it, it would in fact relieve Exxon from the a lot of the liability. They certainly wouldn't be opening their checkbooks on a daily basis. It was my understanding, although you're much closer to it, Mr. Congressman, it was my understanding that the governor had not gone all the way to federalization. What he had said is he would like to see the Coast Guard take a bigger role in the guidance and direction and the management of that thing, and we're willing to do that and moving to do it right now.
And I would support that with the understanding one of the weaknesses I believe in this whole incident has come out. We had actually 3 generals in the field.
Hopefully the Coast Guard doesn't have a spill, but I do believe that would work.
The Coast Guard being the general. And if we can set it up as doing that for this bill and future spills, I think we ought to agree to that system where one person has the responsibility of directing, regardless who's responsible, of the spill. And hopefully the Coast Guard doesn't have a spill. But I do believe that would work, and if that's what he's asking for, I think that makes sense. But to take and make sure it's federalized, I have very serious reservation about the responsibility then, and I'm not saying that lightly. You know, Exxon has spent a lot of money, and they're going to spend a whole lot more if I have my way. But I want to make sure that no one's relieved of their responsibilities. But to have you run it, I think it would make a correct system, you making the decision, make sure this cleanup takes place, and any future, and God help us if it ever were to occur. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Young. The chair is pleased to recognize the gentleman from Florida, former chairman of this committee, Mr. Hutto.
Perhaps to make some Admiral Yost stated correctly that alcohol is a legal drug. That being the case, in carrying out an important mission like transporting oil, wouldn't it be a wise idea perhaps to make some special consideration and ban alcohol from the personnel on board the tanker?
I think that makes a lot of sense. Most companies, including Exxon, do in fact have an absolute ban against alcohol aboard the vessel. The Coast Guard, in order to enforce it, instead of having an absolute ban so that we had to search a vessel to find an offense, we have a ban against people using alcohol before they take a watch or having a blood alcohol level above 0.04. That's well below, by the way, intoxication. So, as an enforcement tool, we require anybody that is on duty to have a blood alcohol level below 0.04. We've looked at banning it completely. There's a certain level at which you can test. It's very difficult to test much below 0.04, so we use that as a threshold.
Okay, Admiral Yost, I understand that the Coast Guard does not require the approval of contingency oil spill plans. Alyeska had a contingency plan, but you were not required to in any way review or approve that plan. Is that correct?
The Alyeska contingency plan was a requirement placed on them as a requirement for the permit from the state of Alaska. The contingency plans that the Coast Guard has and requires are first the national contingency plan, and under the national contingency plan, there are regional contingency plans for each region of the United States. Under those regional plans, each federal on-scene coordinator, the Coast Guard, senior Coast Guard officer in each port, has his own Coast Guard contingency plan. Now, these plans locate, designate the fragile areas. They locate the equipment, the boom and the skimmers, where they are, how you notify them, how you get them there, the organization. Now, we do require at each loading facility of a chemical or oil that the company that runs that facility have a contingency plan for cleaning up any spill at that facility. Now, what we're talking about here is a plan to clean up Prince William Sound, which is a very large bay area, and that it was a state requirement before Alyeska got their permit. The Coast Guard does not have or require an agency to have a contingency plan for a large bay. For instance, what agency would you say ought to have the contingency plan for the Delaware River or the Delaware Bay or the Chesapeake Bay or San Francisco Bay? We have a local Coast Guard contingency plan on how we will stand up the organization to clean up a spill.
Would you recommend that the Coast Guard have more authority in approving regional plans or more than local plans?
Well, the regional plans are a federal plan. The local plan is a facility plan. We do approve, right, sign off on those local facilities for each dock and loading facility, fueling facility. So we do that. Where you have a problem is when you have a high sea spill or a spill in a large body of water that nobody is directly responsible for as a private corporation.
Understand that Alyeska estimates that under their plan, 50% of the oil would be recovered either directly from the water or after being washed off of the rocks, and 15% would evaporate, 15% would be recovered from the shore, 15% would naturally dissipate or disappear or disperse, and 5% would remain in the environment. Do you have any indication of any of these facts being borne out in this situation?
Well, some of them, but not all of them. To begin with, the Alyeska plan provided for the biggest spill that either Alyeska or the state, frankly, could imagine. The worst-case scenario for that plan was one-fourth of the amount that was actually spilled in this case. In other words, the plan was built on a worst-case scenario of about 2.5 million gallons. In fact, we had 10 million gallons, or four times that much, actually spilled. So the plan to begin with had a major fault, completely inadequate, and it's not surprising that the response has not been as effective as the American people and the Congress would like it to be, or me either. Now, of that 10 million that spilled, we had about 3 million evaporate. Of the 7 million then that's still in the water, we've cleaned up about, by we, all the agencies, and Exxon and what have you, about 500,000 gallons. Now, that's 500,000 gallons out of 7 million. That's all that's been picked up. That is the same amount that clings to the side of the tanks in this tanker. There's 500,000 gallons still in the tanker that's just clinging. You can't get out. So it's a very small amount that we've been able to clean up in the last week or two. Frankly, that will become less and less and less as a rate of pickup, because the oil is harder and harder to pick up as it weathers, scatters, spreads. So the 500,000 we've already picked up is a more than we can expect to pick up in the immediate future. What you're going to clean up now is going to come off the beach, going to come off of rocks, going to come in sorbent booms. It's going to be very, very difficult to get much of the rest of the 7 million gallons out of the water.
Okay, well, you're dealing in gallons, or and the information we have here is in barrels. It's my understanding that there were 240,000 barrels that were spilled. Is that
That's
correct?
Right.
And the contingency plan, I believe, would indicate that 200,000 or almost all of that could be taken care of. But I'm assuming from what you said that the experience is that since we don't have much experience in cleaning up oil spills, that it's not going according to the plans. Is that pretty much true?
Well, we've got a lot of experience in cleaning up oil spills. Ixtoc 1 was the biggest oil spill the world has ever known. We cleaned up what came on the Texas coast from that. The Burma Agate off of Houston was one of the biggest problems we had in the U.S. waters. We were able to clean up that. But nobody has ever had in American waters 10 million gallons in the water, 240,000 barrels, that was dumped in the water within 2 or 3 hours in a remote location, some 20 or 30 miles from a remote location itself, Valdez. It is very difficult to get to the logistics on scene to do that. Now, though we can criticize, and I do criticize Exxon for being very late in their response, what we had here was a massive, massive situation that we as the Congress and the American people and the United States Coast Guard want to get cleaned up immediately and see it out of the water, and it's something that isn't going to happen, even though we all want it very badly and we're going to try very badly. It's beyond beyond man at this point with what we have to do what we'd like to do.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen. Gentleman from Virginia, Mr. Bateman, is recognized. The chair is proceeding in order of seniority on the subcommittee. Mr. Bateman.
I think we received notice within about 20 minutes of him going.
It was made to the Coast Guard being on board the Valdez within 3 hours of notice. When did the Coast Guard receive notice of the incident, the first notice of
I think we received notice within about 20 minutes of him going aground. When a vessel goes aground, normally the skipper's first inclination is, how do I get it off of here? Within 20 minutes, he notified us he was hard aground.
Do you find any thing to complain about or any objection that should be raised for lack of more prompt notice to the Coast Guard?
No, I don't think that. I think 20 minutes is very reasonable notice. I think getting Coast Guard people on deck and starting to interview people and smell people's breaths and what have you within 3 hours when you're in the middle of the night in a remote location of the world and 25 miles from that remote location by sea is also all that I could expect.
Admiral, I was seeking to focus on the time lapse from the point where there was information that the tanker was losing oil into the environment to the time that there was a tanker there to offload and to minimize the amount of oil that would be spilled. And it looks like to me there's almost a day and a half, 2 days, before there's anything on site to begin the offloading operations. Is there a problem there that we should be concerned about?
Well, I think there are a couple of problems there. One, the tanker's piping system was damaged to the extent it couldn't be used. And when that happens, the only way of getting oil out is out the top, and you have to have submersible pumps. Now, the submersible pumps for that kind of thing are in very short supply. The United States Coast Guard owns a great proportion of them worldwide. We station those pumps, some of them near the Gulf Coast and some of them in San Francisco. Within hours of being notified the problem. We had a C-130 airborne with pumps and people from our Pacific strike team, and when they got aboard, by that time, very shortly after, tankers and barges were available. Before we started pumping, Exxon brought an architect on board, and the naval architect said, stop, don't do anything till I analyze the damage here, because if you people start pumping this thing in the wrong sequence, you're going to break the back of this ship, and you're going to have not 10 million in the water, you're going to have 53 million in the water. So some of these things had to be done, and I think we've got to visualize night at sea in a remote location, decisions being made on the best information. And I'm not at all dissatisfied with the time it took to get Coast Guard pumps on board, naval architects, and analyzing the thing, even getting a tanker on board to pump into. That went all right. I would have liked to have seen boom there a little faster. I would have liked to have seen the 5 hours met by Alyeska. That wasn't met. I think we can all guess, second guess, how much difference that made. The fact of the matter, it wasn't there, and we're going to examine that. In fact, the President has directed Secretary Skinner and myself and Mr. Riley to completely analyze the response and to report to him within 30 days, which we're doing.
Chairman, I'll yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Bingham. I appreciate that. Mr. Clements of Tennessee is recognized.
Yes, Admiral Yost, I understand that the shipping lanes into and out of Prince William Sound are well marked for oil-carrying vessels. Since the opening of the oil terminal at Valdez, how many incidents have there been of tankers straying without authorization out of those shipping lanes?
Well, I'm not aware of any. I'd have to report for the record on that how many ships actually left the traffic separation scheme that's laid down on the chart. I think you're going to find very few have done that, and certainly none so as to endanger the vessel that I know of, but I'll report on that record.
So you really haven't had a problem in
that area?
There's
been no groundings, and there's been 87,000 tankers, 8,700 tanker trips through there, no groundings of any kind, no collisions. It's been a very safe operation.
Reports continue that crew members of tankers reporting at Valdez smuggle alcohol on board their vessels. I know it mentioned a while ago. But what steps, if any, are the Coast Guard taking to improve surveillance of crew members boarding vessels tied up at Valdez?
Well, we haven't addressed that. I would say this. The responsibility for enforcing those regulations on board a tanker belong with the master of that tanker. Now, where you have something break down is when you have the master or the person responsible for the enforcement and the setting of standards when he breaks those standards himself. That's what we have here, and it's not possible for the Coast Guard to enforce alcohol standards on tankers at sea. That's up to the master. And, of course, when we board, if we see something wrong, if we have a report of something wrong, if the master or any mate or anybody on the ship reports that somebody's using alcohol, we investigate that. But it's very difficult in this case when the master himself was allegedly the abuser.
The Coast Guard, as I understand, has agreed to the state of Alaska's request that shipping at night through the Prince William Sound be discontinued. In your opinion, is night shipping inherently dangerous?
No, it isn't. On the other hand, I have imposed on that system some very, very rigid standards while we're cleaning up this spill. I've imposed on the Vessel Traffic Service a plotting standard, a keeping track of tanker standard, a no night operation standard, using two tugs to escort every tanker. That's far and beyond anything that I would thought of doing or anybody would have thought of doing 3 weeks ago. I'm going to continue with that regime until I get the results of a board of investigation that I've appointed to look into the actions of the vessel traffic system at Valdez, the Coast Guard system, until I get the recommendations of the National Transportation Safety Board, which I requested investigate this spill. If those two reports give me a strong indication that I should keep some or all of these extraordinary measures in place, I, of course, will do so in consonance with my secretary.
Admiral, I've heard a rumor that oil tankers leaving Valdez routinely take a shortcut that avoids a large portion of the traffic separation scheme in Prince William Sound. To your knowledge, is this true?
Well, I saw that reported in a newspaper this morning, and I saw the response of one of the local Coast Guardsmen there that said that's ridiculous. He'd never heard of such a thing. I think that the Coast Guardsman is probably right. That's a ridiculous allocation. No tanker skipper would ever do that kind of thing, and certainly we wouldn't allow it. It's against the regs. It just wouldn't happen. What we have here is a master who strayed, or a third mate who strayed, not because they intended to, but because something very extraordinary happened on that bridge, an extraordinary lapse on that bridge that we'll find out about, I hope, in this investigation.
We will have to, under the agreement we have with the Senate.
Thank you, General.
It is 10:30. If the Admiral will allow, I will recognize the former chairwoman of the Federal Maritime Commission, now a member of our subcommittee, now full committee, Ms. Bentley of Maryland, for questions. And then we will have to, under the agreement we have with the Senate, release the Admiral to appear before the Senate. I understand Secretary Skinner is here. Admiral, we will, at some future date, though he's not here yet, we will at some future date request that you return. We can continue this line as indeed this cleanup progresses and as we get closer to some of the issues we want to decide, hopefully, this committee level. The chair will now recognize Ms. Bentley of Maryland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Admiral, 20 years ago this year, we made an experimental run of tankers transiting the Northwest Passage to test the possibility of transporting oil from Fort Barrow to the U.S. East Coast. I was fortunate enough to be on that pioneering trip, and I recall how the tanker became icebound on several occasions. After viewing the horror of the Valdez destruction, I can only say we're lucky that the Northwest Passage was ruled out. But on that trip, the Coast Guard had a cutter, the North Wind, accompanying the SS Manhattan. And the North Wind then had difficulty keeping up because it was an old, old vessel. You mentioned here that the Rush, which is on duty up there now, is 40 years old now. Is one of the problems the fact that the Coast Guard has not had the kind of budget it needs to build some modern cutters? I mean, so you can work on these disasters with more expeditiously.
As I've discussed with the chairman, we are facing a major shipbuilding program that we have got to get into and got to build and replace a large part of our cutter fleet. Fortunately, the Coast Guard cutter Rush is one of our more modern vessels. She's only 20 years old rather than 40, so that was a mistake that was made someplace. She's doing a very good job up there, but the North Wind has since been decommissioned. We only have two polar icebreakers left in this nation, and I cannot discharge the vital needs and responsibilities of this nation with two polar icebreakers. It can't be done.
What are the ages on those vessels?
Well, the two that we have are about 15 years old each, but the ones we just decommissioned were over 40 years old. The oldest icebreakers in the world. Active icebreakers in the world.
Now, we note that the number of Coast Guardsmen you have on duty up there has been reduced rather drastically to seven people.
We took seven people out of Valdez in 1988 when we got the significant budget cuts that got to be so famous in the Coast Guard.
That's when they tried to cut down and shut the Curtis Bay Coast Guard Yard, too.
Yes, but we thought better of that later. Good.
But this is all because those budgetary cuts that resulted from money being shifted from the Coast Guard to Amtrak.
That's right, and I've asked this Board of Investigation to examine to see if the cutback in the number of watchstanders at Valdez had any effect on this accident. That's one of the responsibilities of the board. But in fact, we did reduce the watch by one during that budget cut in 1988.
Now, at the time, there was some report that the Coast Guard people on duty at the time of this incident were actually trying to watch the additional traffic, or there was some more additional traffic up in the Port of Valdez, so that they weren't concentrating on the Esso Valdez.
There were no other ships in the system at that time. The watch, the procedures of the watch provide that once the vessel is clear of the Narrows and is down at Rocky Point and discharges its pilot, that there's no further requirement for tracking by the Coast Guard radar. In other words, the vessel is in clear water, it's 10 miles wide, and the procedure has been to the vessel proceeds on her own without a pilot at that point. So the Vessel Traffic Service was not tracking the tanker. The procedures did not require it to track the tanker. The extraordinary procedures that I've imposed on that system in the interim require tracking the tanker to the very furthest extent of the radar coverage. Where this tanker went aground was very close to the maximum extent of the radar. I'm not convinced, however, that the vessel could not have been tracked had the procedures directed it to be tracked even to that point.
Would a double bottom on this vessel help relieve the 10 million barrels from
possible? We don't know yet the extent of the damage. It's also possible, maybe even probable, that the extent of the damage was so deep that it would have come through the double bottoms, and double bottoms would not have been a help. Now, you know, double bottoms have been criticized as being counterproductive to ship stability once a ship grounds, because they use those double bottoms as part of the flotation for the vessel. And once they're penetrated, you lose that buoyant.
I'm not pleased with the wording of the application. I've not had occasion before last week to examine that application in detail.
Coast Guard is more specific than saying minor traffic violations where he could excuse or rationalize himself away from it.
I'm not pleased with the wording of the application. I've not had occasion before last week to examine that application in detail. I'm not pleased with it. I want to tighten it up. I want to do exactly what you want to do as a prosecutor, and we're going to do that.
I think the members of this committee can rest that wording on that question. It'll be changed. Is that
yes,
safe?
Yes, sir. You can rest assured, sir.
And Exxon's made all that information
available. Was this master in the employ of Exxon?
Yes, sir. He was an employee of Exxon, a long-time employee of Exxon, and he had gone through an alcohol rehabilitation program funded by Exxon some time before.
And Exxon's made all that information available to you?
Yes, they have. In fact, the president of Exxon U.S., Mr. Stevens, has testified, or in a press conference that I attended in Alaska last week or so, that he felt that Exxon made a mistake in returning that master to the bridge. Now, that's Exxon's statement, and I'm not going to comment on whether that was a mistake or not. It's fairly complex whether you take a rehabilitated person.
Yes, sir. You can rest assured, sir.
With it, I want to tighten it up. I want to do exactly what you want to do as a prosecutor, and we're going to do that.
I think the members of this committee can rest that wording on that question. It'll be changed. Is that
yes,
safe?
Yes, sir. You can rest assured, sir.
And Exxon's made all that information available.
Was this master in the employ of Exxon?
Yes, sir. He was an employee of Exxon, a long-time employee of Exxon, and he had gone through an alcohol rehabilitation program funded by Exxon some time before.
And Exxon's made all that information available to you?
Yes, they have. In fact, the president of Exxon U.S., Mr. Stevens, has testified, or in a press conference that I attended in Alaska last week or so, that he felt that Exxon made a mistake in returning that master to the bridge.
That's Exxon's statement, and I'm not going to comment on whether that was a mistake or not. It's fairly complex whether you take a rehabilitated person and return them to their job or whether you don't. And if you don't, how many people are going to come forward and say, I need rehabilitation? That's something we're going to have to look at very carefully.
Whether it was a mistake or not, did you find that Exxon had any procedures for monitoring people with the responsibility this master was given when he was returned to work with it? I don't know the terminology. Is there a second mate, a third mate that would have that responsibility? Have a
responsibility. Well, as far as I know, Exxon did not have any machinery in place to monitor this. Now, the master is the master. However, the chief mate and the chief engineer particularly have a responsibility, a clear responsibility on a merchant vessel. If the master is incapacitated or unable to command for any reason, to replace him, to record in the log why they have replaced him and relieved him from command, and that will be adjudicated when they get to port. Now, they better be right, but they got the responsibility to do it, and so there may be some other responsibilities here.
Can you assure us that masters who have returned to work after a drug or alcohol abuse rehabilitation program will be monitored in some way by either the Coast Guard or the employer, such as Exxon? For a
period of years. I think that is an excellent suggestion. I'll certainly look at it. I haven't thought it through. But we do, anybody who has a drug abuse history cannot even apply for a license of any kind for a period of 3 years, and then they've got to show very, very clear rehabilitation references and statements and what have you. With alcohol, it's somewhat different because it is, in fact, a legal drug.
Admiral, I think it's a courageous step when an individual goes to a drug or alcohol rehabilitation program, and I'm not suggesting that they be terminated from all employment forever because they've done that. My concern is if we're going to spend the money, such as Exxon apparently did, putting the master through the drug or alcohol rehabilitation program, that he be returned to work but have some type of monitoring process so they can yank him rather than have to go to a press conference and say we made a mistake in returning to work.
I think that would be an outstanding and a needed corporate policy. What I need to examine is whether we as a government should propose rulemaking to require that kind of thing of the corporation, or to place a responsibility on federal officers to somehow monitor this person. That's a different question. We need to look at it. It's a good question.
Well, you have my support on that. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gentlemen's time has expired. Admiral, our new intelligence is that the Secretary of Transportation has not yet been released from his assignment on the Senate side, and therefore you're being held until... until we have obtained his release.
I know how those
agreement.
People felt in Iran. I thought I was going to escape early here, but apparently not, sir.
Not so. I also would like the indulgence of the full committee, as I've already obtained the indulgence of my friend, Mr. Coble, to recognize out of order the appearance of our full committee chairman, the Honorable Walter Jones, for a round of questions. Mr. Jones is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry that I'm a little late, but this is the fourth meeting I've had this morning, somewhere or other. Admiral Yost, one or two questions, if you will, please, sir. Exxon has expressed frustrations over the clearance process that delayed its use of the dispersants until they were no longer useful. Could you describe the dispersant clearance process and why it took so long?
Yes, as you know, Mr. Chairman, the use of dispersants is a very controversial issue in oil spill cleanup. In Prince William Sound, in consonance with the state government, the sound has been divided into three areas. One area that the on-scene commander may use dispersants at will. The second area that the on-scene commander may use dispersants with the concurrence of the regional response team. And the third most sensitive area where dispersants will be used under any circumstances without the full agreement of the state authorities. Now, where this chip was in between Area 2 and Area 3, in other words, it was a sensitive area, and the use of dispersants had to be carefully considered. The use of dispersants that Exxon wanted to do was not possible without a lot of consultation. And in addition to use dispersants, it takes three conditions. You've got to have a concentrated area of oil, you've got to have a mixing of the oil, and you've got to do it in a timely fashion. Now, none of those things were immediately apparent at the onset, except the timeliness. There was no mixing, the oil wasn't concentrated, and it wasn't in an area that dispersants would normally be used. So a lot of consideration was done. I don't fault, and I don't think Exxon has really faulted the on-scene coordinator. I've listened to Mr. Rao, the president of Exxon. He hasn't really faulted. He's merely said, if we could have used dispersants, maybe it would have done some good. In the view of the on-scene commander, it wouldn't have done any good, and he tested them, and he said no. And I've got to say, that's a decision made in the field, and I seldom in Washington second-guess those kind of decisions.
I don't think that there was
Admiral. Finally, some people have criticized the decision to concentrate on removing the remaining oil from the Exxon Valdez because it slowed down the cleanup of oil or its spill. Would you care to comment on this?
I don't think that there was particularly a conflict between these two activities. The removal of the oil from the tanker was done under the supervision of the Coast Guard strike team. It was done primarily with Coast Guard ADAP pumps, with the help of other pumps that were brought on at some time later. It didn't interfere with the response to booming and skimming. The response to booming and skimming had its own problems of equipment available, isolation of the area, getting things out there, booms blowing away, a 70-knot wind coming up. There were plenty of problems that hampered the response, but pumping off the tanker wasn't necessarily one of them.
Much attention, Admiral, has been directed to the skipper.
That's all, Mr. Chairman, this time.
Captain Hazelwood.
I thank the chairman very much, and I also, again, want to thank my friend for his indulgence. Mr. Coble is now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Admiral, good to see you this morning. Unfortunately, under these conditions, much attention, Admiral, has been directed to the skipper, Captain Hazelwood. I want to focus for the moment on the third mate, who presumably
at the time of the tragedy.
If you will, Admiral, tell us, if you know, if the third mate was in fact qualified to discharge the duties that he presumably was performing in the wheelhouse at the time of the tragedy.
I don't have personal knowledge, but I am convinced that any third mate of a tanker of that size, having taken the Coast Guard license and been hired by a company like Exxon, a big corporation, was in fact a competent mariner. This was a competent mariner who just didn't happen to have pilotage for that stretch of water. Now, pilotage requires a certain number of round trips. He didn't happen to have that number of round trips. But here we have a licensed, presumably competent mariner of a major ship, one of the major ships in the world, hired by one of the major corporations in the world. I think, until proven otherwise, we've got to assume we had a competent mariner on the bridge. Now, there was some kind of an awful lapse on that bridge. We don't know what it was. It's almost unbelievable that there could be a lapse of a competent mariner of that type who would run that ship right up on a rock in an area that's 8 to 10 miles wide when he should have been heading past Hitchinbrook to sea. It's inconceivable to me, and for that reason have I appointed this board of investigation and the National Transportation Safety Board investigation to try to find out what happened on that bridge for that 9 or 10 minutes that ship was doing 12 to 15 knots in the wrong direction.
Well, it's inconceivable to me, too, Admiral. I'll admit we have the benefit of 20/20 hindsight here. But I was going to get into this, the general from Alaska did earlier, but I was going to ask you to comment, but you already have, that this, in fact, did not involve a situation where delicate turns and expert negotiation would have been required. Inconceivable is the word. Admiral, my good friend from Alaska, Congressman Young, alluded to this a little bit, but I'd like to extend it, if I may. If you will, Admiral, tell us how a vessel traffic system works, number one. And number two, does the traffic controller submit or make recommendations as to course changes to a ship's captain?
The vessel traffic system in Valdez is comprised of two pieces. First, the radar center, the plotting center, and the communication center. And secondly, the traffic separation scheme that you saw drawn on the chart that goes from the Narrows on down to Hitchinbrook. That traffic separation scheme merely provides that the vessels incoming and outgoing go in two lanes so that they don't have any chance of colliding with each other. Now, that system is a system that we do not have any radar observation of. We have communications of, and vessels in that system have to report in at certain checkpoints and give us the changes in speed they have and any changes in course. We monitor that. And we advise them if they've got any other ships in the system so they know where other ships are, when they'll be passing ships, and that kind of thing. Once you get into the arm, you then transition into the area that is too narrow for a separation scheme, and that's the radar monitoring scheme. Again, we plot those vessels while they're in there every 3 minutes. We don't allow two vessels to pass in that area. It's a one-way sort of thing, and we keep it clear until the tanker gets all the way through. We give him reports of what he's liable to see. If we see him getting one side or the other, we might advise him of that. But it isn't a system that we give rudder orders, or the watchstander would say to the captain, come right 5 degrees or come left 5 degrees. He advises him what he sees on his radar. It's an aid to the captain who's responsible for the safe navigation of that vessel.
One final question, Admiral. During this period that you mentioned earlier of presumed lapse, 8 or 9 minutes, I think you said, was there exchange between the third mate and the traffic system spokesman during that period?
No, there was no exchange. The last exchange was an indication from the third mate that he intended to move over into the other lane or the northbound lane in order to avoid what he thought would be some ice from Columbia Glacier in the southbound lane. And from that time until he reported hard aground, there was no further communication.
Thank you, Admiral Yost. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Coble. The chair will now recognize the gentlelady from New York, Ms. Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Admiral. I know how committed you are to cleaning up this mess that's taken place, and we look forward to working with you in looking seriously at the review process. Because, frankly, after listening to your testimony and your amazement as how this could have possibly taken place, it seems to me that we have to focus on the competency of the people and the person at the time who was steering the vessel. And I just don't understand how someone who had his driver's license revoked 3 times for driving while intoxicated could have been in charge of piloting an oil tanker carrying 60 million gallons of crude oil. I understand that the Coast Guard renews seamen's licenses every 5 years. In order for the Coast Guard to allow a license to expire, it must be determined that the seaman does not have a, quote, suitable character or habits of life, unquote. First of all, I'd like to ask you, do you think that this criterion is too stringent? Given that Captain Hazelwood's drunk driving infractions were all committed within the past 4 years, is a change necessary in the law to allow for the review of the licenses more frequently? And do you believe this should be the prime focus of our attention as soon as we can deal with it?
Well, I think I'm basically in agreement with the direction of your comments and those of of Mr. Laughlin. We need to tighten up the language in those applications. Now, I'm amazed that a man with that kind of a background was piloting a tanker as well. I guess I was equally amazed when we found some airline pilots in a similar check in Florida were piloting the aircraft that you and I fly in with that kind of a record. And it's because there was some fraud in making the application. Now, how far we as a government go behind a citizen's application is a question, and I think we need to examine that when they're flying airplanes or driving super tankers. We need to take a look and see how far we do want to go.
What do you think would be a reasonable time for a review process? Do you think 5 years is sufficient? Do you think we should do it every year, every 3 years?
Well, it's a fairly massive responsibility to examine the mariners in the United States for licenses. We do it every 5 years. To do it more often than that is going to be disruptive to the industry. It's going to require more time and effort on the Coast Guard's part. We have 25,000 licenses per year. That's applications and renewals. Now, we can do that, and it may be coming from this accident. We'll want to discuss that. It's difficult with an accident like this in front of you to know when you're overreacting. And I don't know. I'd like to put a little time between us and the accident before I start wrenching around mariners to examine them every year rather than every 5 years, and adding to the Coast Guard a very major, major increase in our personnel.
Thank you very much, but I hope that we can address this together, because it's clear that these infractions took place within the last 4 years, and given the stress of life, I think we have to look at the time frame very seriously. Thank you very much.
The gentlelady's time has expired. Admiral, I'm pleased to announce, sir, that we are now acceding to the Senate's urgent calls for your departure. And while
one from the Republican side, one from the Democratic side.
Yeah. While I want to give them indeed a chance to visit with you, we're going to allow two additional sets of questions, and we'll limit them as closely as we can to those 5 minutes, one from the Republican side, one from the Democratic side. And we'll begin. I think Mr. Inhofe is next. He's passed.
And I think that we've all learned our lessons.
It's recognized.
Licensing and regulation.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Amtrak has been mentioned.
Admiral, I've listened very closely to the testimony because I came this morning primarily to hear what we need to do, what went wrong. And it appears an awful lot went wrong. And I think that we've all learned our lessons about licensing and regulation requirements. Amtrak has been mentioned today. Airline pilots have been mentioned today. Now we have people on bridges of super tankers being mentioned. And I don't think there's any argument there that we need to do a better job in that area. What I'm focusing on, however, today is the question of preparedness and